conference record has joined the conference.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Ken Raske, president of the Greater New York Hospital Association and co-chair of this task force. And to my right is Joe Belloc. Joe is my co-chair, And we have a very, very interesting assignment, which we will go into in a few minutes. But first, a couple of comments for myself, and I'll turn it over to Joe for some preliminary comments as well. These are challenging times for not only this state, but everywhere in the United States in terms of the fiscal pressures which are on everybody. And, of course, we're talking about the Medicaid program ultimately here, but it goes obviously well beyond it. And the Supercommittee in Washington is dealing with issues that indeed embrace health care and then go well into all the other sectors of the federal government. It is clear that we have been in a protracted, unfortunately, protracted recession, and the economy seems to be going sideways. It's not climbing out of it, as many of us had expected, hoped, hoped for, in fact, a few years ago. Unemployment rate continues to be stuck at 9.1% across the United States. New York is a little better. Has a lower unemployment rate, but nonetheless is feeling all the consequences of what these economic pressures are about. I can tell you that in my day job as president of the Greater New York Hospital Association, we have come to the conclusion some time ago that we have to do more with less. And that's in point of fact the efficiency factor that we are striving for within the healthcare community. It's easily said and hard to do, no question about it, but that is, in fact, the approach that we've taken. It's for that reason that we embraced Governor Cuomo's challenge originally on the Medicaid redesign team, and I applaud all of the individuals that are so much involved in it, Commissioner Shaw, obviously, Jim Introne, to Joe's right, who has been instrumental in this. Jason Helgerson, our Medicaid director, Laura LeFevre, who you're going to hear about in a few minutes, all been doing yeoman's work on trying to come up with a series of recommendations. So on the issue at hand, medical malpractice coverage and reform, I wish us well on this venture. We come in with a wide open slate, and hopefully we can provide some recommendations to the executive branch that will increase the efficiency of the healthcare system as a result. Joe?
Thank you very much, Ken. And I'd like to welcome everybody also. And Ken already introduced Jim Introne, and want to welcome him. Thank him for coming, taking the time to be here. And also thank Laura LeFevre for her assistance in staffing the working group and helping us. And I'm pleased to be doing this with Ken Raske. There is some good news. Ken and I are just getting to know each other, but we have agreed already on one medical issue. We found out that we share the same primary care physician. And I happened to get stop by and get a prescription for both Ken and I today. That's state comp. So we're
that's take two and drive on.
But as Tim was saying, you know, these are serious issues, and they're issues that have proven intractable for a long period of time. And we're hoping to have a very robust procedural discussion of the issues and examine the various sides of it, the data that's underlying it, the availability of the data. I just wanted to say from my viewpoint, I think everybody at this table has great respect for the profession, both legal and medical. We go to doctors to get treated. We go to hospitals when we're sick. They help us, and there's also a real value to the legal profession and the other professionals at this table. And I just want to acknowledge that from the outset. My mother used to tell me when I was a child that. About why people have two eyes, and she used to tell me that the one eye is so that you can see your own fault, and the other is so that you can see the wisdom of others. So I think with that, we should maybe have the panel members introduce themselves.
Arthur, could we begin with you?
Sure. Mark Levin, the Center for Medical Consumers.
John Fagerman,
AM, so the medical liability mutual.
Bill Glass, Big Old Review.
Douglas McKeon, Supreme Court, State of New York.
Judge. I'm Jim Introne from the Governor's Office.
John Bonina.
Pat Kyer, Kramer Dilloff, Livingston and Moore.
Nicholas Lepain, Solace of Lepain,
Rock, Grant.
I'm Fred Meyer. I'm on the
Chris Meyer with the
Susan Sackle, Department of Health. Lauren Abrams, Department of Health.
And Laura Lefay, Department of Health.
And Laura? That introduction, our
thank you very much.
Deputy Director of the Office of Health Systems Management. Barb, would you begin the presentation?
Thank you. So I'm going to go very quickly over the charge of the work group and then what's kind of planned for you all in the coming weeks. And then I thought that I would step back a little bit and kind of put you guys in context for consideration of this issue and talk a little bit about the MRT process and talk a little bit about what the subgroups are doing, because there's a lot of work besides yours that's going on to kind of support the Medicaid redesign. Then I thought that we'd take a very brief moment and talk about some of the initiatives that were accomplished last year. Not only the MIF, but there were a number of other legislative actions that I consider to be very important, and I think you will too. And then I'll turn it over to Susan, and she can talk a little bit about a grant that we're really proud of that we got from ARC, and certainly with the great help and assistance from Judge McKeon, we are kind of moving along with that. So I won't waste any more time. So the work group charge, this was a conversation. So you can see the charge to you all is to review, I'm not going to read it to you, the cost of medical malpractice coverage. There's a lot of things that go on in driving and inputs into the medical malpractice arena, and they're complicated, and they're actually from different points of view. There's the medical system, there's the legal system, and certainly the insurance system, and they all feed each other and all are interrelated. The bottom line, though, is that the recommendations that this work group is being asked to develop for consideration are to focus on a few things. It's reducing the cost of coverage, improving healthcare quality and patient safety, and controlling the cost generally of healthcare. Oops. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, there's a question from the phone.
This is Art Buechner from
Art.
Disney, and also I'm a recovering obstetrician, and I'd like to speak for a short period of time for one of the major drivers of healthcare costs, not only in nationally but also in New York State, and that is the cost of defensive medicine.
This is Ken Rasky speaking, one of the co-chairs. Could we take that subject up a little bit later?
Yes.
There's a segment of our agenda that is really dedicated to the subject matter. And what we want to do first is to set the table. So is that okay with you?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Very good, sir.
And sorry for forgetting you on the phone.
That's my fault.
So the next order of business is just to lay out what the schedule is here. It's pretty aggressive. We've got a meeting today, and then we have a meeting back up in Albany where we expect to discuss the tort system and also have some insurance discussion. And then on November 9th back down here, we expect to try to develop some recommendations. So here you are. I'm just showing, for the phone, I'm just showing all of the members of the work group. And thank you very much for taking your time out on such short notice and lending your expertise to this effort. It's very appreciated and impressive. So Medicaid Redesign Team Overview. Medicaid Redesign Team is noted on the opening of my presentation. was focused on working together to build a more affordable, cost-effective Medicaid program. That was the charge. And in phase one, a very big group of folks, and I'll show that to you past this slide, really put together an amazing amount of 78 recommendations that were passed in the 11-12 budget, and the implementation is underway. You all fit into phase two, being the work groups that were convened. There are 10 of them, and we'll cover what they're doing a little bit later. And the charge there is to develop and support more recommendations for the governor and the legislature to assist in this kind of redesign of Medicaid. Here are the members of the bigger MRT group, and as you can see, there are it's an amazing breadth and depth of expertise and years of history in healthcare from all different perspectives. So phase one. So as I mentioned, there were 78 phase one proposals that were approved in the budget, and we are moving along with other state agencies to implement them. The MRT phase one bottom lines are this, is that it is going to reduce Medicaid spending by $2.2 billion in this fiscal year. It enacted a whole series of short and long-term cost controls. It capped Medicaid spending growth in state law, which is a very large groundbreaking concept for Medicaid, I would say.
This is the only state in the United States that's done that. Is that correct?
Thank you. I don't know. Is that true? I believe you would know that.
Yeah.
It also begins a three-year phase-in to manage care management for all. I think that our healthcare delivery system has focused on paying for services and has really shorted the concept of managing the entire care. You hear this a lot in the debates. So this set of recommendations really begins that discussion. And it also asks consumers to access medical care a little differently and asks providers to provide it differently. So those 78 recommendations will now currently save about $1.2 billion, and to date, about $600 million has been achieved. They're either completed, in process, or substantively completed. One of the key features of the agreement last year, as Ken points out, only one in the country, was this global cap. And what the global cap did was put a hard dollar amount in place for 11-12 and 12-13. You can see $15.3 billion and $15.9 billion. It's also very consistent with what the governor articulated he wanted to see, which was a limit on total Medicaid spending growth to no greater than the rate for long-term medical component of CPI, and that currently is at about 4%. DOH, at Department of Health, and the Division of Budget closely monitor Medicaid expenditures on a monthly basis and report out as to where we are in achieving savings. And the deal was that if those savings are not being achieved on a monthly basis or as expected, that the governor and his executive branch would be able to step in and assist in that savings. But really the handshake and the commitment to each other was having the industry really self-monitor and initiate improvements so that it could, you know, meet its savings goals. So you can see here on this slide that we have MRT savings, which is the 78 proposal. There were savings taken from inflation. There were across-the-board reductions. And then, as I just mentioned, there are industry-led contributions. And this is where the provider community has really stepped up and committed to self-monitoring and finding efficiencies in its own backyard. Very historic. The thing about that self-contained cap on expenditures is that it was not qualified. It didn't say, and if Medicaid enrollment starts climbing, then the deal's off, or if another externality that I, you know, couldn't think of at this point in time happened, that the deal's off. The deal was that the industry was going to monitor its expenditures. And as you can see, Medicaid enrollment has continued to grow, bad economy, whatever. So these are expenses that the industry basically has to accommodate inside of that cap, I would say. So far, so good. Right now, as through August, the spending is 2.5% below target, and this just breaks out the spending by different categories, inpatient, outpatient clinic, nursing home, so on and so forth. Some areas are doing better than others, but in the aggregate, the industry is stepping up and doing what it said it was going to do. So now we're here in phase two. And again, phase two was designed to support the initial work of the MRT. You are one of the 10 work groups that was assigned to deal with medical malpractice. They are co-chaired by MRT members, and then we have you all as non-MRT members kind of contributing to the recommendations. Here are all the work groups. It just runs the gamut from all things that really drive and need attention in healthcare. Behavioral health reform is a very huge, huge issue, mental health issues, and drives a huge amount of cost in Medicaid, so there's a whole group focused on that. There's a group focused on what's the basic benefit package for Medicaid. That's the basic benefit review. Healthcare disparities is another very large issue that we're all thinking about and certainly needs to be addressed. Housing is another large issue. And, of course, there's medical malpractice. Yes?
Let me just add, not on the list of work groups here, but associated with this effort, it is a very large undertaking by the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities to substantially redesign its system. And it's off on a separate process, but it's going to consistent with MRT recommendations to enroll all individuals, all Medicaid recipients in some form of care management within a three-year period.
Thanks, Jim. So, again, websites have been created to kind of collect all of this information and allow the public to comment on the work that you're going to be embarking on. We've got people on the phone listening in who couldn't be here in person today. We're going to post all of the work materials on the website so people have access to seeing that. And we will also post, you know, audio minutes. So the charge of each of the work groups was to meet at least three times and submit a final package of recommendations to the larger MRT. That larger MRT will review the recommendations and vote on whether or not that recommendation would be forwarded to the governor. The time frames are astonishingly small. there are some work groups who are already forming recommendations. We're beginning in the mid-October, and by early September, we need to be able to make those recommendations. And just for context, the reason why that is because we want to be able to offer to Governor Cuomo the possibility or consideration of putting recommendations into his executive budget if that's something that is related to the budget. So that hence the very compressed time frame.
I'm sorry. If I could add again, just to be clear on the recommendations, there's not an expectation that between October and December all the problems associated with the Medicaid program are going to be resolved through recommendations for the various task forces. And in many respects, these recommendations will have to do with how we approach the problem in the future. They're really intended, depending upon the committee and the level of understanding of the issues and the kinds of recommendations that already are in the public arena, they'll be more or less specific. And in many cases, I think the task forces or the working groups are going to be developing general recommendations and setting out an agenda for future work.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim. This is just more process for you. Here are the timelines. November 1st is the big the first of two larger MRT meetings, and at the first in November, they're going to consider recommendations on health disparities, behavioral health reform, managed long-term care, and program streamlining. And then at the December 13th meeting in December, consideration of recommendations on the rest of them. This is just more time frame, December 31st, final MRT report. Mid-January, the governor's budget is released, and then there'll be an update sometime in the spring. So the MRT itself, again, you know, phase one, a lot of things that have been accomplished and actually in process. We'll have recommendations from the various work groups, and this will really establish a framework, as Jim points out, both short-term and longer-term for Medicaid to redesign itself and move forward. There's also a discussion about whether or not some pieces of the action plan that gets put together will be put into a comprehensive 1115, which is a federal waiver from the state to the federal government to help participate in some unique ways of transforming ourselves. But it is a big effort, needless to say.
Laura, before you move into the next session, task force members, any questions about any part of her presentation, charge, composition, timelines, anything you want clarification on? Okay.
Thanks, Ken.
Nope, nothing noted.
So now that we've kind of established the context within which the work group is operating in, you know, the question is, well, how does, you know, medical malpractice really relate to Medicaid cost containment? And I think in order to kind of set the table a little bit more, I would say that, you know, first we need to look at the kind of the landscape. And this certainly isn't a complete panorama of everything factual about medical malpractice, but it's a quick kind of look at some important elements of that landscape. You know, we've got medical malpractice premiums that vary, and I think Jeff will talk a little bit more about that today, pretty dramatically by type of service that a physician offers and where that physician offers the service. We know factually that medical malpractice expense represents about 3 to 4% of hospital budgets. Hospitals in this state generally break even, so that 3 to 4% is really a lost kind of reinvestment opportunity, if you will. Not that it's not a necessary expense, it's just in the context of things. Premium rates have been increasing, and again, it's hard to get a handle on what happens with premiums because there's a lot of different ways that medical malpractice insurance is purchased in this state. Some people are, you know, have the captives, other people are purchasing from companies and physicians, so it's kind of a mixed bag, and then we've got risk retention groups that are out there now, too. Obstetrics certainly, and this is I'm going to drive it home to Medicaid. Obstetrics is a very large driver of payouts, and as we've seen, claims and payout growth really hasn't grown all that much in the last 5 years, except the average payout on OB has grown significantly. And the other thing of note is that there's just a limited amount of underwriters of medical malpractice in this state for any number of reasons that have been discussed in the past. We have noted that recently there are some new entries into this market, but not, in my estimation, not significant at this point. So now I'll bring it back together again on why, again, medical malpractice expense and cost is so related to Medicaid. Just walking down the facts, hospitals spend about $1.6 billion on malpractice expense. That's about 3% of their operating expense. About 35 to 50% of a medical malpractice premium is attributable to obstetrical cases. Medicaid pays for over 50% of the babies that are born in this state, and in certain parts of the downstate area, in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, it goes as high as 70%. So that you know, kind of from a Medicaid perspective, in my mind, kind of lays the table on why it was so important to talk about medical malpractice. So last year in the 11-12 budget, there were a number of things that were accomplished to move the checker forward. So these are the highlights. There was a medical indemnity fund created. There was something called the Hospital Quality Initiative created or asked to be created. The commissioner is in the process of setting it up. It also had a subgroup attached to it to focus specifically and exclusively on obstetrical safety. That's something that we felt was very important. The hospital quality contribution is the an assessment that is made on inpatient obstetrical cases from hospitals, and that raised $30 million for the healthcare reform pool. There was also a belief that we weren't doing enough, the government, wasn't doing enough in recovering that which we could already recover, which were liens against Medicaid that reside in the county. So there was an incentive built in, and I'll flip through that quickly, built in for counties to help and assist in recovering those Medicaid liens a little bit better. And then, again, mandatory court settlement conferences for medical malpractice cases. So the MIF, as we call it, Medical Indemnity Fund, was set up for children who had been found by a court or a jury to have sustained, I won't read all of this, neurological injuries as a result of medical malpractice or to have settled a lawsuit. And this it applies to all cases that were settled or awarded after April 1 of 2012, regardless of when the injury was to have taken place. So after April 1, it was in effect. And the applicant could be either made by the parent or the defendant. Administered by the Department of Financial Services, the MIF was operative on October 1. We've received two applications so far. Emergency regs were developed by ourselves and with the input of a lot of the consumer advisory groups, and actually we met also with a number of stakeholders that I can see around the table as we were developing the regs, and their input was extremely helpful. The fund will pay for qualifying health care costs into the future for this person, and you can read what it will pay for, and that qualifying health care costs are those not covered by collateral source if private insurance is available. So the money of the fund is held in by the commissioner for that purpose. The fund will pay providers for those services, and as I mentioned, there was $30 million deposited this year from hospital assessments. Actually, let me back up. It wasn't paid for by hospital assessments. There was an allocation made in the budget of $30 million for the fund. The assessments go into a big checkbook. And also, just last, but there's an annual actuarial calculation for the fund, and if the current liabilities, and I should have put current in here, if the current liabilities are 80% or more of the fund's assets, then enrollments will be suspended until new contributions from the state are provided. Hospital Quality Initiative, you can read this. The idea here is that quality can't get left off the table in this discussion. We are at the point of putting this together. We haven't gotten it put together yet, but we hope to very soon. And then the obstetrical safety work group, more focused on obstetrics, as you saw, was a big deal in terms of driving Medicaid costs. Quality contribution I covered. Settlement conferences. So the law also provided that the court will hold mandatory settlement conferences for medical malpractice actions within 45 days of the filing of a note of issue. I think that this really builds off of Judge McKean a lot of the work that you have been doing, and certainly all folks around in the legal community have been working on, and trying to really have a discussion, a full-blown discussion, before we embark on going into a full-blown trial. So I think that this has a lot of positives. And our friends at the Unified Court System had that up and running 90 days from April 1. I saw Tony out there, and that was a big lift for them, but I think it'll be really helpful. And last but not least is the Medicaid lien collection that I was talking about. So the commissioner is authorized to work with counties to incent them to collect on those Medicaid liens and actually offer them a little bit, 10% savings, to induce them to do a little bit better job. So that's the portion that I was going to cover. And unless we can stop and ask questions or discuss.
Well, why don't we take a time out for that? Thank you, Laura. That was an excellent presentation as an overview. Would anybody want to comment on any part of it?
Hi, Laura. John Bonina.
Hi.
You mentioned incentivizing counties to recoup the Medicaid expenditures, and I also noticed that in the last 6 months or so, there was a new CPLR section, CPLR 306C, which mandates at the commencement of any action, plaintiff's lawyers notify both the local Medicaid office and the Department of Health of the commencement of an action so that recoupment measures can be taken. And my question is there any estimate concerning the effect of both the CPLR 306C coupled with the incentivizing counties? Is there any estimate of the effect that new statute will have on Medicaid recoupment and therefore on Medicaid's bottom line?
Yeah, I won't answer the question specifically because I don't know the exact dollar amount that was expected at this point in time. And we have been working with the folks at the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General because they have some other personal liability collection efforts that they were making. And I haven't really touched base with them to see how it's going and if they're seeing any, you know, differentials in collections.
I just, for everybody's benefit, if you're not familiar with it, there is a Medicaid redesign webpage that's linked to the Department of Health webpage, and it has all the information that was generated in association with the initial effort, including the financial savings attached to all of the MRT proposals, and that information I'm sure would be there.
Yeah, I'm off the top of my head, I'm not remembering what we assigned to that.
Okay.
Judge McKean. Chairman Bullock and Chairman Rasky, thank you for including the judiciary with this work group. I think it's the first time we probably have been included in these kind of discussions, and we're very, very grateful to you for the invitation. We've been working certainly with the fund, I must say, some instances with the trial bar as well in trying to formulate its meaning and its purpose. Our experience with it up in the Bronx has been very, very successful. I think the early settlements have come up in the Bronx. We've done a lot as far as setting some parameters for the allocation portion of the fund. When these cases are settled, future medical expenses, which are paid by the fund as incurred, are one category of damages, and everything else is a second. That everything else is paid in cash, the fund substitutes for what used to be upfront cash in a resolution of an obstetrical case. And so one of the issues was allocating as between those two categories of damage. I've had many discussions, frankly, with some of the representatives from the trial bar on that subject, and very, very cooperative and collegial discussion. What I have found to be quite remarkable is the fact that some parents have come down to see me, basically because there is a lack of a comfort level among some of the bar and the judiciary with this subject. And so some lawyers have asked that parents come to speak to me. And the notion of a lifetime of guaranteed care from a fund dedicated to obstetrical-related injuries is something that, quite honestly, gives a great deal of comfort to some of these parents. I didn't expect to see that kind of reaction, but I am seeing it. And so that's been our experience with it up to now. I guess others will talk about the savings that seem to be coming from it, but from our experience, it seems to be rather significant.
Thank you, Judge. Other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm interested in the timetables around the hospital quality initiative. When do you expect to see the dissemination happening in the timetable?
Well, we're convening at this point in time. What the legislation asked us to do, the commissioner to do, was put together a group of folks, and hopefully that'll be very soon, and then we'll get going on setting an agenda. I think what we're going to want to do is have these experts kind of define what that agenda should be. There's so much going on in hospital quality at this point in time.
Is that happening in parallel to our work? So this will be happening around the same time. The recommendations from this group will be.
I think your group is going to be on a much shorter trajectory than the hospital quality initiative.
Thank you.
Yes, Art Levins. So this is just asking for clarification. Having been around long enough to watch the excess med mal pool be eviscerated for other purposes, I'm assuming that nothing in the Constitution state prevents somebody, the legislature, namely, from dipping into this fund. Am I right? I mean, there's nothing that was created constitutionally that says, I understand that funds are not to be commingled with other funds, but the fund is not sacrosanct, I don't think, and unless there's something in legislation that made it so.
Anything done by statute can be undone by statute.
Correct. So there was no constitutional amendment. We would all known about that. But I think that the commitment is for a lifetime of care for those children that enter the fund.
Judge McCain?
I would say, as Ms. LaFay pointed out, there is this cutoff once the liabilities of the fund exceed 80%, so there is that built-in protection.
Thank you, Judge. Any other comments?
Just one question with regard to the fund and the projected savings. What is the current
the last year in 11-12, I should have come better prepared for this question, but I believe that the savings amount was about $180 million in Medicaid savings. Okay? But I'll go further and say that, you know, the savings is really predicated on reductions in premiums that are expected
as a result of the
MIM. Yes. And so we've been hearing anecdotal, and I know you'll hear probably a little bit more today, that there's anecdotal evidence that some med mal carriers have dropped their premiums for hospitals by 20%. So
that's the experience so far.
Anecdotal, limited.
That will be on an annual basis.
I believe that's true.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes,
Joel Glass.
Joel, hit your button.
We dropped premiums by 14% by going forward basis. So we figure the annual effect is about 14%. The premium the effective effect. Retro is hard to, it's hard to figure out. So we're given a 3-year commitment for 6%, and then we'll track the experience on a retrospective basis and get possible actual savings that they achieve through the retrospective aspect of the fund. The thing is that hospitals have different obstetrical malpractice components in terms of premium. The inner city hospital in the Bronx and Brooklyn are much more significantly affected by obstetrical loss, and their savings is higher than people in Westchester or New York County or upstate. So the savings is not equal across the board.
Okay, Joel, thank you. Any other comments or questions? I'm not seeing any hands raised at this point. Joe, shall we move on?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to have a number of guest presenters.
Ken, can I jump in? We're going to do Susan Senegal next to talk a little bit about the ARC grant.
Got it.
It got buried.
Yes,
sorry.
It got
buried in there.
Sorry, that's on your line.
Yeah. No, that's okay. So one of the unique efforts that we've directly or indirectly, you know, all taken up as stakeholders in medical malpractice is this $3 million grant that I referred to that we secured along with the Office of Court Administration. Actually, they are the primary grant recipient. And five major medical hospital systems downstate. And their insurers. And again, thanks to Judge McKeon for helping us put that together. It's unique in that all of the elements, as I see it, all of the elements of the medical malpractice process are really attended to in the grant. It's been about a year now, year and a half, and the jury certainly isn't out, but we're still putting it together. And it's a real pleasure to have the project director, Susan Senegal, here today to just talk briefly about how that's going. Susan?
Thank you. I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on how the grant came about on a federal level and then the different tasks and goals that the grant has, where we are currently, some next steps, and then I'll take any questions that you have. As you know, a lot of the attention for this grant began in the fall of 2009 with President Obama's healthcare reform initiatives. And at that time, he revisited the issues of medical malpractice, patient safety, and defensive medicine. From there, his mandate to the Department of Health and Human Services was basically to authorize a set of demonstration grants that were intended to implement patient safety initiatives and to stem liability costs. Mostly the malpractice costs that came about from injuries that were sustained in the hospital. In response to that, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, which is our sponsoring organization, put forth an RFP in about January of 2010, of which many of the people in this room, Laura, Janet Cohn, Judge McKeon, Tony Cimino, Judge Kluger, Judge Ann Fow, jumped on this chance to put together something for New York State sometime, not realizing possibly that they could get the grant at times so that it would be potentially coming to New York. Well, lo and behold, in July of 2010, the grant did come to New York State. And as Laura alluded to or spoke to earlier, it was awarded to the Unified Court System. It's partnered with the New York State Department of Health and five hospitals in New York City, Beth Israel, Maimonides, Montefiore, Presby, and one more, Mount Sinai, that's it. Very good. And then our esteemed Judge McKeon, who brings the court perspective. We also have collaborated with Richard Boothman out of the University of Michigan with his Communication and Resolution Program and with Michelle Mello from Harvard School of Public Health to do the evaluation component. Okay, can you go to the next one, Laura, first, and then go back to that. Okay, so when you talk about the New York State model, what is it? Because for a long time, Judge McKeon had been working with judge-directed negotiations. So we had parts of the judicial system in place. And if you look to the left, there's the hospital environment, which is somewhat chaotic on the diagram and actually in real life as well.
But it deals with patient safety, and it deals with early disclosure. We prefer to use the term communication. Disclosure kind of gives you the sentiment that you're hiding something and that, therefore, you need to disclose it. Communication in the hospital and between a patient and physician occurs every single day. It's not a matter of disclosure. It's a way of giving people information about their medical care. So when we talked about this, when you look at some of the things that they've been doing, one of the things that we were a little weak on in the hospital environment and everywhere is really the candid discussion of errors and being proactive in compensation and resolution. We say we've been doing it, but how well have we been doing it? So if you want to go back to the next one, Laura. Yeah. So the project goals were basically for the Department of Health, the top three are heavy in our realm, and that's to develop a culture of patient safety, to enable and promote complete adverse event reporting, and to create, it says disclosure, but it's really a communication and an early settlement program. The fourth one was in the court system was expanding a judge-directed negotiation program, and then we hope to demonstrate the effectiveness of the model, disseminate lessons learned, and expand the model. Concurrently, we are that the courts have expanded their end of the model in the Erie County court system. Okay. All right. One of the things that I really feel strongly that we don't put enough emphasis on is the prevention part of a lot of the healthcare errors. It's sort of like quit smoking so you don't get lung cancer. People really kind of delay that and deal with the crisis at the time. So patient safety is really important, and patient safety really begins with having freedom from the accidental injuries of medical care. And by that, we mean the culture is characterized by what people do every day. That's a matter of going to work and thinking in the front of your mind that you're reducing medical errors because you're being careful. That's a large part of this grant, and it's not the part that draws a lot of attention, but as you go through this and you think about these things, you will come to realize that this is the backbone of preventing patient errors and reducing medical malpractice. So how do we look at patient safety culture? ARC has a survey. It's called the Hospital Survey of Patient Safety Culture. Makes sense. It has 12 domains, and you elicit the input of your staff. Another no-brainer, but really getting the feedback from the people on the front lines is important. A lot of times we issue surveys, and as administrators, we kind of shield ourselves from the results, thinking, oh, what are they going to say? And we don't really deal with them. This grant puts that survey and the patient's, the staff's concerns on the forefront. There are 12 domains that are measured, and each hospital is expected to choose their lowest scoring domains and implement interventions to improve the score. Complete adverse event reporting. There is the necessary part of patient safety is to find out where errors are. You can't solve them, you can't prevent them if people don't feel that they can talk about them. And in order to talk about them, once again, it circles around to the culture that you live in and the culture that you work in. Are your concerns heard? Are your concerns dealt with? So the objectives here were really important to not look at adverse event reporting as we need you to get more. If you have 9,000 adverse events, and that's not necessarily errors, so let's make sure that that's out there in the front. It wasn't our goal in the project to say, gee, we really want you to report 10,000. This is a systematic look at the system of where they enter. Are you aware of where you can get the information? Is the data actionable? Do you have analysts that can look at it? Are you holding yourselves accountable? Is it easy to access the system? That's really what we're looking at for complete adverse event reporting. So an adverse event is any injury that results from medical care and is not the result of an underlying medical condition. It doesn't mean that it was a mistake. It doesn't mean that it was negligent mistake. Doesn't mean that someone did something wrong on purpose. It's just an outcome of medical care. For example, if you are given penicillin and you have an anaphylactic reaction, it's a terrible thing that this happened to you, but someone gave you the correct dose at the correct time. They looked at your medical history and saw that you had no allergies. Lo and behold, you did at this point have an anaphylactic reaction to penicillin. That's an adverse event. And this is the part that everyone was rather nervous about. This is the part that was like, from the hospital perspective, we're already doing this. I said, I know. show me how. And from everyone else's perspective was, well, are you really telling them? And if you tell them, will this mean that we're going to incur more lawsuits if we talk about adverse errors, if we talk about negligence, if we talk about your care? What we're really talking about, and this is kind of the bottom line, is a patient deserves to know when something went wrong. And 9 times out of 10, the cases that you're talking about and that you litigate, they know something went wrong because they're either sent back to the emergency room or the operating room, or something occurs that they need the information to care for them. And the hospitals are very good at doing that, but they have to be able to show that and measure it. When you say we've done it in a soft way, we've done it in an informal way, you really need to look at the processes you have in place in order to find out if you're doing it well. And that's what we're looking at from this perspective. The turning point in this was a communication class that we had with Greater New York and a private consulting firm and the hospital staff. These were the surgeons in the room, not just the administrators. And it talked about communication training. It wasn't, what should you say? Is this protected? Is this not protected? This was, you're dealing with another human being. And here's how you should speak to another human being, knowing what they're about. This is what this personality type generates. This person asks a lot of questions because they're an analytic mindset, and you need to be able to allay that in them. So that was the type of communication training that we did. And at that point, I think really the entire group took a deep breath and really realized that the importance and the intimacy that this project has with patients' lives. So from there, I think we've really made a lot of strides in going forward. Can the next one? I don't have a lot of interaction with this. I have had the pleasure of being with Judge McKeon in his chambers to view or witness the judge-directed negotiation, but I can tell you that they have identified the judges to participate. They've trained them. They had, I think, Tony, I think it was three-day training classes for the judges, and they have hired an RNJD to give non-biased medical expertise. So far to date, when we do this project, it was really important because a lot of people thought this is a study. You know, we've got to have labs. We have to know exactly what interventions we're doing. This is a demonstration study so that you're really talking about real-life experience. There are certain things that we want to do across the board on the project. We want to make sure that they've all administered the SOP survey. We want to make sure they all have their results. We want to look at communication training sessions, and we have a communication and resolution protocol that everyone has agreed to. All 5 hospitals came to consensus and said, all right, this is how we're going to look at this. But at the same time, you have to recognize, again, the culture of the organization. A Mount Sinai is not the same as a Maimonides, is not the same as a Presbyterian, is not the same as a Beth Israel. And if you can recognize that and work with the clinical leadership, the administration there, and even the patient population there, then you have a much better chance of success. You have to have flexibility in the system so that they can own it, they can buy into it, and they can feel a sense of empowerment and go forward long after this grant is finished. What we're going to do over the next year and a half, we're almost halfway through the grant period now, is to look at specific goals that other hospitals in this group have found successful. We looked at some of the measures, and it's always easy to say, well, in New York State it's different. You can look at a national benchmark, but that doesn't play in New York. Well, when you have 5 hospitals right here in New York and they all differ significantly on some measures, somebody's doing something different and better than someone else. So what can we learn from that? And that's the part that we're at right now. We want to integrate the practices, though, to support a common theme. What can we walk away with from this demonstration grant that'll show that we've done something successful? And Michelle will be talking to you later today about measurements of success in any medical liability project. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Susan. Any questions? This is a very exciting project.
We have actually expanded what had been a program which we utilized solely with the Health and Hospitals Corporation to Montefiore cases and to Columbia Presbyterian cases because they are the 2 principal hospitals in the Bronx. And while they're technically not grant cases because grant cases that Professor Miller is going to look at are new cases. We've had for the last year expanded our previous Health and Hospital Corporation program to those two hospitals, and I'm told anecdotally, and you know perhaps Mr. Glass can speak to it, it's been quite successful, and quite frankly, it's something that goes along quite well with the medical indemnity fund, because it's our hope that the savings from the fund can be utilized to perhaps save other kinds of non-obstetrical cases sooner rather than later, with the savings and reduction in defense costs that flow from that. So we've had a good experience, certainly in the last year, in expanding it to private hospitals. Obviously, municipal hospitals have a benefit in the sense that they're not an insurance company. They have a notice of claim requirement. They get an opportunity to find out about the case prior to suit. All of those things are lacking when one speaks about a private hospital, but certainly this program makes things better than they were before it.
Thank you, Justin. Any other questions, comments?
Yes,
Pat.
I think this is what you missed out on. I'm not sure you know the answer, though, relative to the early disclosure and settlement program before there's any litigation initiated. Do you know whether any
I don't. This process just began 2 months ago as far as the deadline or the cutoff for, launching now. So I don't know of any settlements right now.
Do you know if there's any procedure in place for when people who are approached, when they're approached, recommending that they receive some kind of counsel to make sure that they're getting a fair deal?
That's an integral part of the process, and in the CRP document is that they're advised. And actually, it's almost to the benefit of both if they do have legal counsel. You feel that people are understanding the issues at point then.
Thanks. Fred? Fred, hi.
Hey, thank you. And Susan, can we go back to the Department of Surgery? That strikes me as a very important place if we're going to get anywhere. What do you see happening with the surgeons? How do they participate in this endeavor? What difference does it make to them? How have you addressed the question of diffusing understandable defensiveness, if you will, in such a setting? What do you see happening there, funding?
That's the crux of really what you have with physician communication. There's always the issue of defensiveness towards the patient, defensiveness towards their practice with their peers, and that's a difficult place to break through. And that, again, it speaks to the culture of the organization and the people that work there. If people understand that mistakes happen or something happens and we're all human and we want to learn from that, it really bears to someone opening up to say, gee, you know, that really happened to me 5 years ago, too. So let me give you an example of one of the hospitals. Team Steps is a communication program for teamwork within units, and it really talks about people being able to communicate issues during surgery, from the scrub nurse to the circulating nurse to the person who's doing the instruments on the side to the surgeon to the anesthesiologist. It's not always one big happy family. You know, people get into their routines and oftentimes don't communicate, and some people feel too intimidated if they've only just recently started. One of the hospitals just took their entire surgical team down to Tennessee for a three-day seminar in communication skills training as part of this grant that's funded by this grant. And that's a big deal. When you take surgeons offline, that's revenue. And to take that amount of importance from the senior leadership team to say this is so important that we think you need to do this, that helps with the physicians making a difference and feeling that they can communicate. But you're right, it still is, you know, it's a big hurdle to jump in making someone feel comfortable enough to admit their mistakes. Anywhere in this room, we're all the same way in that we feel sometimes uncomfortable showing our weaknesses. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
John? My question is more for Judge McKeon and the early settlement program. First of all, I want to commend you for your leadership with respect to the program and for the successes that you've had already with it. My question deals with the nature of the hospitals that are in the program now and the ability to expand it
either A, to other hospitals, or B, to all medical malpractice cases, either in the city or statewide. It seems to me, looking at the hospitals that are in the program, for the most part, they're hospitals that are that maintain captive insurance, that have their insurance as captive insurers and do not, for the most part, have doctors with consent policies. And my question is, what effect do you see the presence of consent policies ultimately having on the ability to take a program like this and the savings that it can implement statewide?
About 3 or 4 years ago, in a rather informal program that we had in the Bronx, we took some of the non-municipal hospital cases and tried to apply more vigorous settlement techniques to them. And we found that we were settling about 65% of those cases. Of the other 35%, half of those cases were not settled because of the consent policy. It's obviously a problem in the sense that some physicians will not consent until the very last minute, until they have to clear their calendar, or they feel rather strongly about their position. And, of course, they're not coming down to a courthouse and participating. So this issue of consent policies is something that is quite important. We in the Bronx have tried to deal with it from the point of calendar management. We believe that there were too many of these cases that were coming before various judges only to be told, well, Dr. Jones wants consent. So we have tried to identify these cases, reduce court appearances, or at least we diminish defense costs to try to deal with them in that way. But you're quite right, John. That's
a factor that doesn't help us settle those cases.
Other questions?
Yes, really excited to hear about this. How are patients woven into the culture survey results? Are there focus groups, or is there more about that?
No, the survey is developed for staff and staff that has an interaction with a patient, so it's not someone who is in a back office. The patient is not drawn into that, and that's an excellent place that we need to look at, because right now people are reticent to survey patients after they have an adverse event with error and are harmed. It's very difficult, you know, to survey them and say, so how do you feel about how we dealt with all that? You know, what's your opinion? Because it seems insensitive, but it's also a really important measure. We need to figure that out to bring them into this.
In my experience, that some patients, you're right, will not want to talk, and others will not stop talking.
That's right. And there is actually another project on a national basis that's using an ethnographer, and that's a really good way to do it and something that we're looking at as well.
Thank you.
Very good. Any additional questions, comments, thoughts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Art Fugner again. I do have one question of Judge McCain. And that is, how would you compare his program with what Phil Howard's been recommending, and that is specific health courts?
First and foremost, our program does not take away from a litigant the right to a trial by jury. To the extent that we have judges who have some training in medical malpractice and discuss these cases from the medical point of view, I guess one might say there is that similarity. We just have as a philosophical proposition that a medical malpractice case has to be discussed for settlement purposes a little differently than the typical tort case. And therefore, we're very much into medical discussions, and we are very, very vigorous in dealing with these cases right from the beginning and investing the judge with the case, always exploring the possibility that there may be an opportunity for resolution. The health court concept is different, obviously, in the sense that, as I understand it, there would be some kind of schedule award. We don't have that. Obviously, the more cases you do, similar cases fall into loose categories as far as value is concerned. But ours is really a negotiation process rather than an adjudication process.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much, Judge. Anything else? Anything else from the panel? All right. We're now going to hear from our guest presenters on the subject of the cost of medical malpractice coverage for physicians and hospitals, the impact therein of on the Medicaid program, on providers, and on the healthcare delivery system overall. Our first presenter is Jeff Taylor from Excelsis from Rochester, New York. It was nice that you could join us. We appreciate the fact that you had to travel a fairly long distance to get here, sir. And you have reported the publication of an analysis of sorts on physician coverage and what it looks like across the state of New York. Would you be kind enough, sir, to make that presentation?
Sure. I'm sorry, just before you get started, just in terms of the plan for today, just so everybody's aware, that Michelle Mello is evidently participating by phone, not in person. So our plan is to try to get through the next three presentations, take a short break for lunch.
Yes, absolutely.
And by 2, she's available.
That's right, yeah.
So then at 2 o'clock, we'll start with her. So just so we have
okay. Thank you very much, Joe, for that
clarification.
Hey, Jeffrey,
you can hit your microphone, too.
Yep. That's good.
All right, Jeffrey. First of all, I want to apologize in advance that if you see me leave the room, it's because Rochester doesn't have a whole lot of flights. So I'm of a little. So when Kodak was really big, it was a different story. But so anyway, some of you may be wondering, why is the health insurance plan presenting on this, and the short answer is, because Ken asked me to, the longer answer is that we get into these kinds of subjects because we think of ourselves at least as a little bit of a different kind of orientation of a health plan in a community. We have a service area, for those of you that are not familiar with us, we're about 39 counties in upstate New York. We've got about a little less than 2 million members. We have about 3,600 employees in upstate New York. We're not-for-profit, mission-based company that's dedicated to serving our local communities. We probably go back about 80 years in history across upstate New York. And one of my little pieces of unusual background is I'm the grandson of the founder of the Utica Blue Cross Company from the 1930s. So there's some, I guess, blue blood through the veins or something. I don't know in Houston. So our orientation is also a little bit different in the sense that our holding company, which is the Lifetime Healthcare Companies, has under its roof not only a health insurance company, but it also has Lifetime Health Medical Group. So we actually have medical practices under our umbrella. So we're very much into both sides of the healthcare coin that we see are one of the same, that the healthcare financing and delivery are very much part of the same picture. So that's very much our perspective. A part of what we do is research on educate on relevant healthcare topics. So we've done lots of research on different things. So medical malpractice is part of the specialty. So I feel a little nervous sitting between the two gentlemen that are to my right and left, since a lot of the stuff comes from their company, not mine. So I'm sure they'll kick me under the table if I'm wrong, but I've gotten sort of feedback that we're not off the mark in terms of the numbers that we came across. What we went into for this fact sheet is to pretty much try to answer, in general, four basic questions. How much does medical malpractice coverage cost? Does it vary within the state, and if so, by about how much? What does it cost in other states? And is there a definitive study that shows the cost impact of medical malpractice in defensive medicine? A little note of caution, as you're going to see in the next few slides, is that the last time we really looked and did a fact sheet on this was prior to the August adjustments of malpractice rates. So what you're going to see are the malpractice rates that went through June of 2011. So there were some adjustments, obviously, in August, but they were pretty small. There were some decreases, some increases, and some stayed about the same. They were very close. And so what you'll see is the variations that are before you and on the screen can show you that from the low to the high, you're talking about three or four times a difference on malpractice premiums that are paid within different territories of the state. You have, for example, since you were speaking before about OBGYN, we've got a premium, a standard premium rate of $36,000 roughly in Rochester community, and of course a Long Island rate of about $186,000. It's obviously pretty distinct difference in the cost of the standard medical malpractice premiums. One other note is that these are obviously standard rates and that they are subject to discounts and a number of different credits. So what a physician pays or what a hospital pays on behalf of a physician who's employed by the hospital can have some real variations here. What I'm going to do next is let everybody in the room know that I'm not going to do the old Tim Russert blue state, red state pictorial here. This has nothing to do with politics. Just to right-size what you're going to see in the next three slides after this is that the states that are depicted in blue have regions in which they have medical malpractice rates that are lower than New York's lowest rate, and the red states are the states that have premiums that are higher than New York's highest rate. The idea here is to show you sort of the range and all over the ballparkness of these rates. I just made up a word. The samples that are outside of New York State are principally based on a review of a publication called the Medical Liability Monitor. It's a really terrific publication for this group. I would commend that you consider subscribing to it if you don't already. It really does do a very good, thorough job of surveying medical malpractice rates around the country. Obviously, a survey is only as good as the data that comes in, garbage in, garbage out, but this seems to represent somewhere in the range of 60 to 75% of the business, I think. So on the next slide here, what I'm going to do now is just walk you through the three standard group practices that you see in most of the literature that range from internal medicine, general surgery, and OBGYN. And you can see the various rates that are before you. I circled in purple sort of the lowest rate that I could find in the country and the highest rate that I could find in the country, just so you can see where those ranges are. Just like in New York State, you're going to see really wide ranges within other states because of the nature of whether or not those states have different regional differences. For example, the Florida rate, probably their highest rate is in the Miami area, and in other parts of Florida that are in less populous areas are probably about half of that rate, so that you have a ballpark that we're not the only state that has lots of regions and differences of probably jury verdicts, experience, and claims. That the same is true with other states. So I don't want to represent these states as being a state average or that this is reflective of the entire state. What we came across was what the survey from the monitor produced. So hopefully that clarifies things as you're looking through it. So the next slide for general surgery, again, pretty wide range from 10,000 in Nebraska to about 190,000 in Florida. And the next one is OBGYN from 13,400 in a portion of California to about 200,000 in Florida. Now, one of the I did a general review of the medical liability monitor just came out with its October edition, and it looks as though not too many changes have occurred by way of rates in many of the states. They've been very small increases, decreases are about the same for many, many states. So you're not going to see probably much difference if you delve into it. The next slide is really sort of a placeholder of, we did lots of reading, and you're going to hear from one of the folks who headed up one of the studies later. The only thing that's very clear from reading the literature is that there's no clear understanding about what the actual costs of defensive medicine are, because of how difficult it is to measure it. It's all over the ballpark from my own reading of it. I've probably read about six or seven studies that range from the 1970s to a more recent one done by the Harvard School of Public Health. But they seem to range somewhere in the 2 to 10% range. But they all say we aren't really sure. So that's why I said that the only thing that's definitive is that it isn't definitive. So those are really the findings. We routinely put these fact sheets up on our website as we research them. We'll probably be updating this one with the latest numbers that we have from not only the monitor survey, but also the Milne numbers.
Any questions? Yes, Lee Goldman.
Show the data by highest and lowest regions in some of these states.
Mm-hmm.
Data on the overall cost, average cost of states?
We didn't produce an average.
You didn't produce a weighted average, for example?
No, we did not. No.
Susan, was there something that you wanted to maybe add on that? At this point, I know you're going to comment a little later about something that came out of Florida in the last couple of days. Maybe that will answer Dr. Goldman's question.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we could deal with that later. Yes, Judge.
Just a comment. I have always felt that malpractice is in part a locale-driven phenomenon. That, and basically, if you look at these states, Michigan, Wayne County, and Philadelphia, and they fall into, you know, certain kinds of common characteristics. And I have, and I don't mean to, you know, throw a red herring into the mix, I've always flirted with this concept of malpractice zones based on the idea of enterprise zones, that there are certain locations which just have such unique characteristics to them that perhaps we can address their medical malpractice problems going outside of tort reform remedies and looking at it as a business or economic model, like tax incentives, et cetera, for hospitals. I'll use Montefiore by way of example. You know, back in 2010, I think it was, the president of FOJP stated that they lose $7,000 or $8,000 every time they deliver a Medicaid baby. I mean, irrespective of what your view is on malpractice, all right-thinking women and men have to say there's something wrong with, you know, that particular fact. And so maybe there are ways outside of the tort area that we can help those hospitals, which are identifiable, which fall into certain locations, or physicians for that matter, that have pay a disproportionate amount of their working revenues for malpractice.
I don't think that's a red herring, Judge. I think that's an excellent point. And the way that we have structured ourselves, at least initially, is that I would think that idea should be explored in the solutions component of our thinking process, which will be our third meeting. So rest assured, it will be on the agenda. And it's you know, it's certainly it's worthy of a great deal of exploration. Joe, do you have any thoughts on that as well?
I don't, but I think that you're right. We should consider anything that worthwhile to solution part, and obviously things that could be done in areas that we can all agree upon. There probably where we should be headed.
Additional questions, Fred?
Just me. Qualify as being in support to some extent of Judge McKeon's observation. It has to do with Florida. I assume that when Ken mentioned we're going to talk about Florida, we'll have the evidence of the closed claim file, which Florida helpfully puts forward each year, it being regrettable that we don't have more closed claim files to study nationally. I've had an opportunity to get to know something about Florida. Accidents of history have thrust me into a role of witness, about evenly between plaintiff and defense cases, of which Florida appears to be an epicenter, quite aside from its role as the center of Medicare fraud and other well-known activities in our field. That's a joke, but it's also true. What is it in your mind, or is there anything in your mind that would lead to this fascinating disparity where we appear to have extraordinarily high-quality institutions that are paying extraordinarily high premiums, and at the opposite end of the scale, very, very low premiums, given the incidence and prevalence of cases that are brought, the constitutional fistfights between lawyers and doctors in Florida and so forth? Is there something going on there that we can learn from, or is it merely a quirk?
Well, one of the main problems is differences in jury pools. The education level of the jury pools, the sympathy factor in the jury pools. There's a disparity that we've done studies on that show difference between Manhattan settlement and award and the Bronx is about a third higher in the Bronx. Now, Montefiore, the judge mentioned, is one of the best medical delivery care systems in the whole state. One of the other factors that you have to take into consideration in some of these areas is the health of the population. The Bronx has a huge amount of obesity, poor nutritional care. These people are sicker. They come in, they have less preventative care. They already come in trouble. Montefiore has 10% of the population, of their obstetrical population, come in through the emergency room with no prenatal care. So there's a variety of factors that create these problems. It's not simple. There's no one simple answer.
I would agree with that. I think you mentioned Florida being a closed system. I believe Texas is as well. Most of the studies that they do related to for example, I think the School of Public Health from Harvard based a lot of its study around both Texas and Florida data. But Melnick can maybe speak more to the claims experience, but that's what, just like any other insurance.
One quick follow-up.
Claims.
Is there any competition amongst carriers in Florida for the provision of malpractice liability insurance?
Yes.
Not in the Bronx. Nobody wants the right.
No, I understand there's no competition
here. Florida,
I'm asking about Florida.
Florida's a regulated open market where there is competition. There's probably at least 7 or 8 licensed admitted carriers are right there, plus risk retention groups that are right inside Florida.
And is there any study, and not to monopolize too much of the air, that could correlate competition between malpractice carriers and lower premiums? Is there anything that would...
The correlation of premiums is a question of frequency and severity inside, whether you're inside territories inside New York State or you're in different states. You know, you combine that with the socioeconomics that Joel has talked about, and you combine that with the regulation of premiums. Insurance is a very highly regulated commodity, and, you know, in New York, rates are established by the superintendent of insurance. Other states, some have violent approval. So it's not a question of so much the competition, it's a question of the environment that generates frequency and severity inside the state or intrastate and interstate as well.
But if we're looking for factors that directly affect what we pay for, would it not be logical to conclude that there is worth looking at whether there should be some competition? Because premiums are what people pay. This defensive medicine stuff, we'll talk about that when the time comes. But the only thing we can really measure is the bill that shows up for coverage. The bill in Florida appears to be astonishingly low, in my view, notwithstanding well-known factors involved with the quality of what goes on in Florida. The premiums in New York appear to be astonishingly high, notwithstanding the fact that I would trust these institutions with my life, and I'm sure you would too. How did we get to the point where remarkably low quality has remarkably low premiums and remarkably high quality has remarkably high premiums? I'm just raising that hypothetically. I realize we've got many, many factors and other people to talk, but I wanted to pick up on the Florida thing, having seen perhaps, for better or worse, in greater detail than anyone you'll ever meet, the peregrinations of Florida doctors and hospitals, as I say, from both sides, and to assure you that their premiums are not low because of their organizational integrity.
I guess this is Edward Amsler.
I don't think anybody here would disagree with it. We have remarkably high quality and remarkably high cost. To comment on Florida is a whole different world, and it's a whole, you know, you have different tort reforms, you have different socioeconomic conditions down there, you have a whole different demographics, and it's hard to compare the two of them. I think our concern here inside is clearly one of a very high cost with very high quality, and how do we control them?
Could I just say, Dean Goldman? Unless I'm misreading, it says Florida's high, not low. So your arguments are, I'm finding hard to understand.
Yes, the judge wants
I think, Professor Hyde, the answer to your question is the risk of the courtroom. In certain locations, people like Mr. Glass have to make a decision whether to settle a case for more money than that case would be settled in 98% of the other locales in the state of New York. And many times doing that because a high jury verdict may raise the ceiling on a certain category of cases, and with that comes other cases for settlement value. So there's a lot of factors that weigh in. I mean, we've heard this term Bronx jury. I don't know if that's applicable anymore because, frankly, and, you know, my friends on the other side of the table can probably speak to this as well, we don't have a lot of malpractice cases being tried up in the Bronx that you would have a pool to be able to make certain findings. But there has been this sense, and it seems to be supported by what you see in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Illinois, that certain kinds of communities with certain kinds of socioeconomic characteristics are, for purposes of assessing risk, far more dangerous in coming back with very large verdicts in the obstetrical field.
Don Fager, did you wish to comment as well?
I refer to the medical liability monitor that Carol mentioned. One company is based in Florida, the doctor's company in Miami, and the obstetrician's rate is $201,000, general surgery is $190,000, and internal medicine is
But as I look at that, it looks to me like that's a description of the Miami-Dade area, right? So that's not, to everybody's point, right? That's not Florida. That's a,
I think we're going to find that we raise a lot of questions. I was intrigued with the intrastate variation, knowing some, upstate there are some very fine institutions. Among some of the finest in the country as well, and the disparity, 300+%, I think you had on internal medicine, probably close to 400% on obstetrics, certainly well beyond the cost of living differences and all the rest of it goes to the judge's point, I think, more than anything else. Joel Glass?
I just wanted to, somebody brought up commercial insurance, and I think we have to at least touch upon the insurance problem. Most of what's going on is really provider reinsurance. So for all intents and purposes, Milnick is really almost a giant self-insurer of its doctors. We are the largest hospital group insurer, but we're self-insurer. We don't have any real commercial insurance. Our premiums run around $300 million. The most of the hospitals in the downstate area have no commercial insurance market available to them. The hospitals in Brooklyn are notorious for the lack of insurance of any kind. Many of them are on a pay-as-you-go basis for a number of reasons, but because they simply can't afford to either put the money away for self-insurance or there is no real market for commercial insurance. And in the doctor area, a significant part of the physician marketplace for insurance is hopelessly bankrupt. We are dealing with at least two of the carriers that, in my opinion at least, will eventually fold and will create a humongous hole in the malpractice environment for physicians in New York State. RRGs that are coming in are, it's like playing Russian roulette. They have no capital and surplus to speak of. They roll the dice. They try to establish lower rates than the state sets for carriers who've already used those rates and found themselves in bankruptcy. So the situation from an insurance standpoint is absolutely bleak.
Questions? Jeff, with regard to the research that was done, was there any research done into looking at studies that have been done, or at least published in the last couple of years, regarding the implementation of specific patient safety programs and the correlation between that and the reduction and adverse outcomes, and in turn, the correlation between that and the reduction in claims and in payouts, and taking it one step further to reduction in premiums? Has that?
No. So even further, yeah. So sorry, I did not
Yes, John. Sorry.
Similar question, and next question, also addressed to you, Jeff. I assume in your role with Blue Cross Blue Shield, you they insure Medicare Advantage policies. In other words, they're insured Medicare recipients. I saw a study last November from the Department of Health and Human Services indicating that medical errors cost the Medicare program $4.4 billion. And my question was, you have a handle in terms of your line of work and what Blue Cross Blue Shield is doing, what the costs are to your medical errors.
I don't have any precise numbers to give you. What I can tell you is that a few years ago, we began a partnership with a number of hospitals in our region where we helped State Cross MedMind to do a detailed analysis for hospitals that wanted to partner. About $7 million to try to reduce hospital fire infections. And we have a number of participating hospitals with us on that and have had a noticeable effect in terms of both lowering costs and actually higher health complications. I don't have the precise
Okay, any additional questions? Jeff, I understand that you have to get going to the airport. You're welcome to stay. We're not throwing you out. By any stretch of the imagination, we'd love to have you stay, but I also understand the problems, the traveling problems that you have.
So it isn't like the Thanksgiving time with the family.
Far from it. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very informative.
Thanks very much.
Don Fager, Milbank. Welcome, Don.
Thank you very much. Can I have to comment briefly on our race and our restructuring of our discussion about race? First, let me apologize for this handout. Despite what you may have heard, we can't afford...
Could you put your switch on? Okay, sorry.
We can't afford to have this printed. And it's in process, but because the department's approval to the race took so long, we haven't had it. We will have it shortly. Okay.
And John, just to interrupt there, so when we get it in an electronic format, what we'll do along with all of these presentations is put them up on the web for everybody to see.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me talk briefly about how rates are set, and in doing so, remember that I'm a lawyer and not an actuary. By law, in 1985, the superintendent was given the authority to establish rates for medical malpractice companies, admitted companies in New York, and he has done so from that time to the present day. What goes into the rate setting? Well, the actuaries look at the projections in terms of the claims that they think are going to arise during the policy period, which would be July 1 of this year to June 30th of next year. What those cases are going to cost when they're eventually settled based upon the data and experience that they look at. The physicians then get the benefit of any investment income on those premiums while they're being held by the companies, as modest as that may be in the present situation. They do get the benefit of that. And there isn't any profit motive involved. And I'm talking about now the admitted carriers like ourselves, PRI, and the other company. So in recent years, the trends have indicated that frequency, that is the number of claims, has gone down somewhat. Now it may be flat, certainly, but the severity, the average cost of the cases continues to rise. So all of that goes into the picture. Now in this, so that has to deal with the overall rate. Now you've already heard that rates differ by specialty and by location of practice. And that is dramatic in New York. And you see in this handout the various specialties, and this list has increased over the years as we've got more and more data. And then one or two comments upon the actual rate. You will see that there are rates both occurrence and claims made. Occurrence, of course, would provide coverage for incidents that occur in the given policy period, no matter when they're reported. Claims made rates apply to incidents that occur and are reported during the policy period. So that in the first year, occurrence rates would be much significantly higher than claims made because we see in the first year about a third of the cases are actually reported. So in the first year, the claims made rate is about 31% of the occurrence rate, but it actually goes up to it. In the final and mature years, somewhat exceeds the occurrence rate. Now, how do we go about determining what each specialty and territory should pay? Those rates are determined based upon the actual losses within those given specialties and within the territories. And each year on an annual basis, our actuaries come forward and present evidence with respect to the experience of the particular specialties and the particular territory, and recommendations as to whether those rates should go up or down. Now, that process is totally revenue neutral, okay? It has nothing to do with the overall rate. And so where there are additions or increases projected, there are decreases projected to even out. So from an insurance standpoint, the money is equivalent. Each year when they make that presentation, it is made to a committee of physicians who look at it and say, we should recommend in this county go up or down, or this specialty go up or down based upon that data. That is colored somewhat by the fact that the number may be too arduous to impose on any given specialty in any given year. There is also concern that if you do specialties and territories in a given year, and you increase, for example, surgery and the county, that the surgeon in that county is going to be hit twice. So all those things are taken into consideration. And then the recommendation is made to our board of directors, and the board makes the recommendation to the superintendent, who makes the decision as to what the rates should actually be. And that is the process. Now, there are dramatic differences, as you know, between upstate and downstate. I think everybody's given some indication of why they think that is so. Certainly the litigation process is different in Monroe County than it is, with all due respect, to the Bronx and Brooklyn. And, those factors all come into play. But in the final analysis, the rates are based upon the actual losses within those territories and specialties.
Thank you. Any questions of John, these data?
I have a question.
Yes,
Pat. We heard from Judge McKean that Joel Alpine in the Bronx, the risk of exposure to the inverted main cause case was several, and that's why recently we hired them. Now, we saw some pretty big numbers from Long Island, our suspicion was $186,000. Suffolk County, as I understand, is from Long Island. I would fairly say that Suffolk County is the anti-Bronx. So then the question is, why would rates be so high then?
A good question. It's one that's not been scientifically studied. There are various and sundry estimates of things that may or may not make any sense. For example, Newsday loves to play up stories about malpractice cases and malpractice awards. Whether that has an impact or not, I don't know. Suffolk obviously is a tourist attraction during the summer months. Is there less of a relationship between physicians and patients than there is in other places? You know, we haven't directed our risk management patient safety activities, which are numerous, towards Nassau and Suffolk, but towards the whole state and to all the physicians, because the problems where they exist in terms of risk management exist statewide.
Joel Glass. Joel, did you touch your
right. One of the problems that exists in rates is Melmac sets the rates. And other carriers are putting in advisory rates, because that's all we do. We put in an advisory rate. The department then brings its actuaries in, and they examine the advisory rates. And really what goes on is they try to maintain parity between the insurers, because they're afraid if they give too high a rate to some of the weaker insurers, then physicians will flee, which will speed up the decline of those insurers. So the rate-making process in New York is very complex and not that accurate.
First of all, I want to thank you
very much for coming. I appreciate your time. I had questions that focused in two areas. One is the availability of data that could be provided to this committee and the Department of Health to really have us look carefully at some of the issues we're talking about. The other subject I wanted to raise with you was the health of the insurers, which Mr. Glass, I believe, was directing. I read the other day in preparation for today that Warren Buffett had purchased a unit of Milmic recently for his Berkshire Hathaway Insurance Company. I think we all agree he's a relatively smart investor, looks for value. Could you comment on the overall health of your company and talk a little bit about that in the context of Mr. Glass's comments?
Yes, and I'm sure Joel was not referring to our company when he made his comments. And we think our company is doing better financially than it was just a few years ago. It is not at a point where we're comfortable with it in terms of risk-based capital standards by any means, but we're working towards that goal. And I agree wholeheartedly with what Joel has said. At least one other prominent company is significantly insolvent at the present time.
Okay. With respect to the availability of data, you file a 2010 annual report with the New York Insurance Department?
Yes.
Is that something that you would be willing to make available to the committee?
You're talking about the statutory statement?
Correct,
yes,
right.
I don't see any problem with that at all.
And would you be willing to include the insurance expense exhibits that are filed with the New York 2010 annual report? And would you be willing to provide that to us for, say, a period of 10 or 20 years so that we can have historical data?
The insurance department has all this information plus the rate filings, and the statutory reports are filed with them on an annual basis.
Yeah.
So, if we can either do it through the insurance, for this purpose of the committee, do it through the insurance department, or we can provide it.
Yeah, I've reached out to the Department of Financial Services. It's called now. It was a merger of banking and insurance, and we're hoping to kind of get them to be able to make a presentation next time. But I mean, this is really helpful in terms of like trying to focus maybe some of the discussion.
Yeah, I think Jeff Taylor commented in his report. I think other people are going to comment that there is an absence of data. The insurance carriers have a lot of that data. And I think, before we're going to do anything here, if we're data deficient, if one thing my brief experience with the MRT has shown me that it's impressively data driven, and I think it's really very important that we have this information. And as, chairman of this working group, I'd like to make any requests we could to the various insurers. And I would include in that the captives, who I believe don't really disclose a lot of this data that we need to make these decisions.
Laura, so you think you can get that from financial services or something on their advice?
I will pursue that.
Don, do you have any more comments about that?
Not on that type.
Ed, the same thing? Okay.
Additional questions?
Any additional questions? Nick and then Matt.
Don, if I could just follow up on what was referred to as the instances of the Bronx-Brooklyn experience at the Nassau and Suffolk counties. And Joel mentioned the fact that there has to be some accommodation for keeping the rates competitive for the higher end risk positions, and therefore that may artificially increase or otherwise be lower premiums for the doctors. And you mentioned, to what extent newspaper articles, Newsday may be a factor. Has there been any study of that?
No. As I said, that we don't scientifically study. Everybody said, why is Nassau and Suffolk as bad as it is? And, they started out quite, and literally right now they've come to the point, again, and watching this every year, they've come to the point where their rates are what they should be.
Well,
but nobody has made a scientific study of why Nassau and Suffolk have worse experience than
otherwise. Has anybody looked into the income factor? In other words, if you compare the incomes of doctors in Nassau or Suffolk versus, let's say, upstate New York, and the disparity in premiums, as far as whether or not there's any correlation there in terms of income.
Why would that be different from New York County, for example?
Well, I'm asking.
No, my answer is I don't see why that would be different, make a difference with respect to New York County.
Well, I'm just saying, factor into that the experience in those counties. That's what I'm mentioning.
Okay, John and then Art.
Thank you.
Question for Don. In looking at the various things that have been published, whether it be on your website or elsewhere, I noticed that you're offering a 5% credit for completing a risk management program, which I imagine goes to the patient safety side of things.
Yes.
7.5% discount for 5-year claim, 5 years of claims-free experience.
That's very new. We just started that.
And someone was mentioning the medical liability monitor recently or sometime this year reported an overall 3-6% reduction in rates for medical liability mutual insured. Over a similar time period, 2006 to 2010, I think the medical liability mutual surplus went from $162 million to $837 million, which was effectively a fivefold increase. And I'm wondering what you attribute the increase in your surplus.
Yeah.
And what you're doing differently over the last few years to result in that improvement.
I don't know that we're doing anything differently. I think that a couple of things have happened, and as I alluded to, the reflection of the reduction in claim frequency has obviously had an impact. Severity is still going up, maybe not as high. We're closing a higher percentage of claims without any indemnity payment in our cases, maybe as high as 70%, which is higher than 70% before. So in the process, the actuaries have looked at the numbers and said your reserves can be reduced. And so the major reason for the increase in surplus is a actuarial recommendation that our reserves could be reduced on our case.
So the good news is this will help shorten my presentation. I think this discussion is reflected in some of the remarks I was going to make on the paucity of evidence, both around costs And having been through similar efforts to in the past, and I appreciate the chair asking for data, it gets repeated every time, this need to request data. I think we would be all well served to have all of this as a matter of publicly accessible in a database that enables anybody who wants to do an independent, objective analysis of what's going on in this sector. It seems to be in the state's interest to require reporting at a micro-cost level that would give us a lot more clarity on what's going on both in the physician market and what the actual costs are to hospitals, not saying that the $1.6 billion isn't correct, but simply saying that we have no way to verify that from the outside externally or to audit that number. I just don't understand how we can continue to be asked to make important policy decisions in this evidence vacuum. And as you suggest, it's not good policy making. So I think one of the recommendations of this group could really be to bring into the sunshine all of the things that are being talked about here and not to have this sort of continuous tug of war, having to ask the carriers and others for their data and sometimes, frankly, having a struggle to get. I'm not suggesting in this case there's going to be a struggle.
Thank you.
But in the past, it's been a difficult request to get.
Mr. Levin, you and I have been on the sides of this table over a number of these discussions over the years.
Jim Intro?
Just a process note. I think that's an excellent idea. What I mentioned earlier, we're not going to solve a lot of problems, but hopefully we'll establish a framework for going forward and improving our ability to make decisions in the future. And recommendations that go to the issue of collecting data, I think, are very helpful. I would just add, I know everybody's very busy, and it's a great disadvantage or sacrifice on the part of everybody to put in the time here on these committee meetings, but we would very much welcome anybody's contribution individually that they would care to make. So in this particular area, to the extent that we and anybody wishes to further define the type of data we should be collecting, we'd be very happy to receive those recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where all this data is that people want to see. Everything is out in the open, and I want to reemphasize what Mr. Glass said. These are provider-owned mechanisms. Our company is a mutual company. It's owned by the physicians and the hospitals and the dentists whom it insures. And those are the people that make the recommendations as to what the rate should be. You know, there's no secret. And none of these companies are in the business to make a profit. Thank you very much.
Any additional questions, comments, thoughts about this?
I have a question.
Yes. Go ahead, Matt.
Relative to this idea of physician owned company, my recollection goes back about 10 years ago. There was a time when MLMIC was giving dividends to the physician as opposed to rate reductions.
Yes.
Is there a reason why it was done in the form of a dividend as opposed to rate reduction?
Yes, because the rates have to reflect what the experience is going forward. The dividend is a comment on what has been accomplished in the past. Rates always have to reflect the experience going forward, what's going to happen, how much money we need to pay the claims going forward. So it might sound inconsistent. You could have a rate increase and dividends at the same time, actually. That just happened in some areas.
Okay. Yes, we've covered the physician side of this in terms of costs of coverage. And now I've asked Susan Waltman, Executive Vice President of Greater New York Hospital Association and the General Counsel, as you well know, of our association to make a presentation on the hospital cost of coverage. Susan?
Before you start today, I just want to acknowledge Susan has spent quite a bit of time, assisting Ken in putting the panel together today and also helping with the agenda and everything. And I wanted to thank her for her time in doing that.
For those of you who have heard me speak or on the issue of MedMal as a task force in 2007, I always start with what we are about, and what we focus on, and obviously what our focus is at the association and in our hospitals is on patient safety and quality, and we'll focus a lot on that. Lorraine Ryan, who works with me and who actually provided the communication training that was discussed, for example, that is our full-time occupation, making sure that our patients are well-served and well-cared for. So we do focus, and that's on my first slide, you know, what is really our goal here and at Greater New York and for our members, and it's really to focus on patient safety, on high-quality, efficient, and effective care, and we very much focus on reducing adverse events and transparency and patient satisfaction, and a great deal of that as well focused on reducing the cost of care, and for the purposes of today and the near future, reducing the cost of medical malpractice coverage. Similar goals with respect to the tort system. I don't need to get into that in detail. That's for another meeting, perhaps. But we very much focus on ways that we can make that system more effective and more efficient for patients and providers alike, and obviously reducing unnecessary costs of that system as well, while at the same time giving fair compensation to patients. I have on one slide, although I don't have only one slide, but I have on one slide kind of a pictorial of what I'd like to cover. And in the middle is the cost to hospitals of medical malpractice coverage or funding in New York State. And I'll go into more detail there. We say in excess of $1.6 billion, it was interesting to find that the direct written premium in New York State and the Florida report that was just mentioned is also for physicians $1.7 billion in that particular document. But for hospitals, we use the figure $1.6 billion. I'll talk about that in more detail. And there are still physicians, as I understand it, will pay $200,000 a year, even though the premium might be a little less than $200,000. They may have surcharges, which is the reverse of dividends and the reverse of some of the things we talked about. We tried to drill down, just as, for example, Judge McKeon talks about, let's look at, in certain areas, what is it that drives these costs unnecessarily? Obviously, there are always going to be costs, but what are the drivers of those costs that we could tackle? We have focused very much on OB. We've talked about that a little bit, because they do contribute a disproportionate share, contribute disproportionately to our members' medical malpractice coverage costs. So while OB might be, from a service standpoint, a small portion of the operations of a hospital, it can be up to 35 to 50%, depending on the hospital and the year, of their med mal coverage costs. It's often due to the neurologically impaired newborn. And many of those cases, I know this is an issue for dispute, but we'll talk about that, are not always caused by negligence. And so it's another reason to focus on this as an area to address. I'll get into each of these areas. It's overall, we've heard this, overall frequency has gone down, so it's really the overall severity that is contributing to the medical malpractice costs that we incur. So we focus on that as perhaps a way to reduce the overall cost. New York severity is among the highest in the United States on the hospital end, as it is for physicians. And finally, the overhead, the exorbitant overhead of the system, and it has been said that it's equal to the overhead. We're the overhead. The plaintiff's bar, the defense bar, you name it, we're all part of the overhead, equal to 54% of the compensation actually paid to injured individuals, and therefore that's something else for us to focus on. And then on the right-hand side, what is really the impact of those costs? And it's always the wrong use of healthcare resources. We will always have malpractice coverage costs, but to the extent they're more than they need to be, it's the wrong use of healthcare resources. Has a negative impact on access and quality. And Judge McKeon mentioned, yes, there are hospitals that will lose money on every delivery or certain kinds of procedures because of the medical malpractice losses, coverage costs. We know there are service curtailments and definitely hospital closures. There have been, and that's a separate focus of an MRT to focus on the difficulties in Brooklyn, for example, and worrying about access there. And defensive medicine, as you well know, there's a big range. It's of what defensive medicine really costs the country. Low number I found, $25 billion. It goes up to $210 billion. I didn't put the number that just came out in the press last week, which went up to like $800 billion or something like that. It's a big number. It is a very wide range. It does exist. Okay. I'll go into where we get the $1.6 billion figure, but I give a bit of the background that Joel went into a little bit already. And as you've heard, there is really not an insurance mark. There is not insurance available to most hospitals in New York State, more so for physicians, less so for hospitals. The unavailability and the unaffordability of insurance for hospitals has meant that there are a lot of different arrangements. And I give you that as a background before I talk to about the numbers themselves. There are those who are self-insured, and I use that there to mean effectively self-pay. They pay as they go along. They pay the settlements, the awards, and the out-of-pocket costs as they go along. There are self-insured with recommended reserves. Sometimes hospitals will come together, and there'll be recommendations with respect to actuary reserves they should be making, and they will make those recommended reserves. So at least there's a reserve that sits behind that self-insured arrangement. Self-insured trusts or RRGs with something that's more akin to premium structure, so they'll actually get a premium bill. There is some commercial insurance that is written for hospitals in New York State. Sometimes it's just that initial layer, a $1 million layer. And then, of course, reinsurance available. And many, many layers that some hospitals will have. So an example may be first layer is commercial, the next is a large self-insured layer, and then above that will be reinsurance. So I lay that out so you understand there's no one type of insurance and no one place to go the way you can, for example, with the insurance superintendent, the Department of Financial Services now, to get how much the premiums are, because it's a very different by hospital. Almost everyone, of course, is using actuaries to develop their reserves or their premium structures, or those who are presumably or self-pay or obviously ballparking their numbers in advance. And I would suggest that means there's no motivation to overcharge or over-reserve, except perhaps to be cautious with respect to your own RRG or self-insured trust. So this is what is the backdrop of the numbers. Go ahead, Lynn. So we have periodically, several times in the past, done a survey of what our hospitals' medical malpractice coverage or funding, because they're self-pay, they don't actually have coverage costs necessarily, but their funding might be. We did a pretty extensive survey for 2010. We do it by having very detailed conversations with CFOs and claims managers, those who are handling the claims, and what you do find is an onion. Each one of these layers will have different costs associated with them, so it's not an easy answer always to get. I will say the 2011 costs are not available. As I just explained, some of the hospitals effectively are self-insured and have reserves, and there's a lot of reconciliation that goes on, so they kind of go into the year. They may even be here to have a pretty good, this point in the year, have a pretty good sense of what they'll spend, but they don't know yet what their cost is. So we have fairly good data from that process from hospitals for 2010. So we surveyed hospitals representing 54% of statewide hospital operating costs. So if you use that as how much of the hospitals in the state are represented by that number, and we came up with total coverage costs of just about $1 billion. So through those various layers of coverage, pay-as-you-go, et cetera, the costs for 2010 were $1 billion. By extrapolation, we say it gets you to 1.6. Well, yes, you're right. It's not double, for example, even though we had 50% of the operating costs, and that's because we did not want to over-extrapolate, recognizing that our hospitals are heavily downstate, although there are some upstate hospitals in there, and recognizing the costs may differ across the state. So that's the reason you have that number. So we just say we think it exceeds 1.6 billion as we do the extrapolation. Just a couple comments about individual hospitals or hospital systems. In the group of the $1 billion are five hospitals or systems that had costs in excess of $100 million each. So five of the hospitals or systems were spending in 2010 more than $100 million each. And of those, four had costs of $120 million or more each. And still of those, because I'm giving you the layers, two had costs in excess of $130 million each. I just want to say in that $130 million each, there's one fairly large system. And there is also, however, just a big hospital with a couple of smaller ones that is incurring $130 million a year in costs. And I will tell you, just as you said, Mr. Hyde, you'd like to think that, well, here you have high quality and why are the Med-Mal costs so high, that in those really high numbers are very high-quality hospitals by national rankings and other benchmarks, and yet they are spending those kinds of dollars. I just want to make a comment about 2011, trying to collect some numbers, go back for a second. What I do know is that the 2011 numbers, yes, you have the effect of the medical indemnity fund, some of its placekeepers, but some of those numbers were going to go up anyway. So it's a mitigation of increases. We'll see whether there's a net, whether they've saved or actually will still go up with the effect of the medical indemnity fund. For one hospital, for example, one of the larger hospitals already told me their numbers has gone from, systems gone from $130 to $140 million for 2011. So you might have this tendency to say, okay, well, the dollars have come down. The increase may have been mitigated. I'm hearing that the dollars may still go up, absolutely. Okay. And, yes, we're a big state. We have a lot of hospitals. We have a lot of beds. I put up here a chart, hard to see, and I apologize. It comes out of the Zurich Annual Benchmarking Report, which is a reinsurance company. I've tried to run it by a couple of the other insurers to say, do you agree with this? But it really was, it's a measurement of Med-Mal costs, losses by bed. Per occupied bed equivalent is a mix of inpatient, outpatient, the risks, the types of procedures, and then figuring out what those loss costs are by that unit. I don't have the rankings in each state, but it ends up with New York being the fourth highest in the country in this particular database of hospitals. And you can see the dark states are those that have the highest loss, the highest cost per occupied bed equivalent. So New York is not just a big state with lots of, and it ranks high, obviously, in terms of the losses per bed equivalent. Okay. I'm just going to go quickly through what I already stated were the drivers. OB, we continue to focus on as a very major proportion of our costs. We come at it from the standpoint we have to reduce adverse outcomes to the extent that we can, and we've very much focused on that. Lorraine Ryan will talk about that this afternoon. We have a perinatal safety collaborative that's been going on for 4 years, trying to focus on the best practices out there in order to reduce adverse outcomes to the extent possible. Very large number of our members participating in that, separately doing a lot on their own. The hospitals, ACOG has guidelines and protocols that it's working with its physicians on. There are insurer initiatives with hospitals and physicians, and the Department of Health has done a lot in this particular area, and obviously the Hospital Quality Initiative. So we start with, we need to reduce adverse outcomes to the extent that we can, but then also being concerned about this disproportionate aspect of our premiums related to OB. And so we do obviously support the medical indemnity fund, provides the lifetime of care for eligible plaintiffs. You heard from Judge McKee, and that is attractive to at least the plaintiffs that he's spoken to, I gather. And then some of the rationale that were put forward, reducing overpayments, some of the double payments, sharing the cost of future medical care. We obviously retain a great deal of the cost for providers, reduces the cost of the Medicaid program, in part by eliminating the double payment. I will tell you that the medical indemnity fund that was passed is more narrow than what had been requested. More narrow definition, fewer patients that would therefore come into it, so that the premiums that the premium reductions that were anticipated are less than what had been anticipated. And that's why hospitals are assessing the impact of the coverage cost. Interesting, very little impact on actual admitted carrier OB rates as a result. The next driver, claims. Obviously, claims are a driver with respect to the premiums and the costs. I'm very much focused on reducing adverse events. As I mentioned, I'm looking not just at OB, broader. And Lorraine will talk about a lot of the initiatives that we're undertaking in this regard. And obviously, that, I think, is reflected in some of the data that are out there with respect to reduced frequency of claims that are brought. I've listed the key elements of successful efforts to reduce adverse events, the same ones you would: culture of safety, collaborative approach, et cetera, transparency, team training, and simply some adverse outcomes cannot be avoided. Not sure what happened to the top there. But this is a chart from the same report that I mentioned, the Zurich report, and they would say that they actually had data from 1,600 hospitals as they sought premiums, sought quotes. The first one is on frequency of claims per 100 exposures. Again, that mix of beds and types of procedures performed. And the states you can see are California, Florida, Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas. So they're comparing them, and in part because they will say that some of the frequency, in the next chart, severity, goes up and down depending on reforms, as well as related to patient safety initiatives. And then the line that goes across is all states. So they've kind of focused on several states. New York happens to be the fourth column over. It's kind of a, comes across as almost black, but it is a maroon. And you can see New York is at the average, national average of frequency of claims, and it is coming down, and that's reflected in the physician data, and at least as our members have so stated. And then at the same time, the severity, for those of you who are in the insurance world, you know severity really just relates to the amount of the payment, not necessarily always the severity of an injury, but the amount of the payment being very high in New York, being the highest with respect to this particular charge. I personally would like to learn more about this, too. You may be asking me questions about it. We would all like to, I think, look beyond the data with respect to these reports. Zurich puts out a lot of very good reports as to the sensitivity of the frequency and the severity, so it's something that we'll be looking at even more closely. Go ahead. Thank you, Laura, by the way, for doing this. And the third cost driver is the cost and the efficacy of the TOR system itself. And I don't want to get into suggestions. You know, that's another meeting. What are the suggestions for reform? But just how does it dictate, what does it contribute to the cost of our coverage? You know, in the Harvard Medical Practice Study, which is discussed a lot, I think it's interesting. It's a very useful report, obviously. It was requested by the state of New York in response to the medical malpractice crisis in the mid-'80s. So the state of New York commissioned it, and it evaluated 1984 claims data. And it is discussed a lot even today, even though the data are almost 30 years old. But many patients, and we know this, with injuries stemming from negligence do not assert claims. We know that. Only 17% of the claims in that particular study actually involved negligent injury. A key predictor of payment was patient's degree of disability, not the presence of negligence. I put what's in yellow for the purposes of this particular group and the driver. And I just want you to know this particular statement does not come directly from the Harvard Medical Practice Study, but rather a derivation of the study that shows up in the article on medical malpractice. The TOR system is tremendously inefficient. Approximately 60 cents of every dollar expended goes to administrative costs, predominantly legal. People are entitled to their lawyers, et cetera. They have to pursue them, but it's a lot of money that goes into the overhead, and that's related to that. I use a figure 54 on the slide, 54%, and I'll get into that. So this is a particularly, I find this very interesting as part of the same article that this, the Harvard Medical Practice Study is discussed, and it really is the tension between this malpractice system and patient safety efforts. The problem is one of conflicting cultures. Trial attorneys believe that the threat of litigation makes doctors practice more safely, but the punitive, individualistic, adversarial approach of the tort law is antithetical to the non-punitive systems-oriented cooperative strategies promoted by leaders of the patient safety movement. So it's exactly what Susan Senecal talked about. You need the transparency. We do need the reporting. We really do encourage it. Nobody has encouraged transparency and reporting and talking to physicians more than Lorraine Ryan, who's done training, a lot of training. But there is that tension between the tort system and the good part that the tort system does and what patient safety experts say is the best way to really improve care. So I just put that up there. And one more commentary with respect to the cost of the system. Many of you have seen this study before. That is similarly the same group of researchers, very well-regarded researchers, published 2 years later than the article. But it's a focus on the tort system, and they went through claims that were closed claims. They were closed over the period of 1995-2004. So similarly, they were older claims as well. And they looked at whether a medical injury occurred, if it occurred, was it due to an error? Not negligence, but error. A broader definition of that the IOM uses, failure of the action to be completed as intended, so negligence is something more narrow. And it goes through claims, this particular claim database. Small number of claims had no medical injuries, yet some of them had compensation. 37% of claims with injuries did not involve errors in that broader definition. 20% of those yet resulted in compensation. And of the injury claims that did involve errors, 73% did involve compensation, which meant 27% didn't. I mean, and I know that as I read about this study, there's a bit of a half-full, half-empty kind of aspect of what you're looking at. But it really shows that the system, even using a very broad definition of error versus negligence, is paying for claims that it shouldn't. Is not paying for claims that it should, and there is an inaccuracy in the system, and I just want to go to this. But one thing that came out of that, too, again, for what's the driver, the overhead expenses are exorbitant. And this one says 54% of compensation paid to plaintiffs goes to the cost of litigating the claims. Average time of resolution is long, long periods for plaintiffs to wait, long periods for defendants and doctors and others to endure the acrimony, therefore a high-value target if you want to reduce the cost of the medical malpractice coverage world and streamline the process of claims. So I don't want to get into necessarily what those resolutions are. I'm just saying that's another place to focus. I have only 2 slides left. You know, I think we all agree, no matter what you agreed with or didn't agree with on the slides so far, I think we all know that the system, whether it's the healthcare system or the tort system, is meant to serve the patient. Obviously, what a patient deserves. So we really do want to reduce adverse outcomes. Significant patient safety efforts are underway, notwithstanding that there's a lot about the tort system that discourages those. And we also think the tort system can do a better job of serving patients, whether it's the patients who never enter the tort system or whether or not it's those many patients enter the system who are not injured or but not due to error. And some receive extraordinary payments, and a lot of the extraordinary payments are what drive sometimes the premiums in the last slide. So our goal, to focus on, continue to focus on patient safety, and Lorraine later will talk about what we're doing in that area, reduce the cost of the tort system by, in these ways, can we streamline it? Can we make it more efficient and more effective? Can it be less acrimonious? I think it's a lot of what Judge McKeon does in the Bronx. That's exactly what you bring to the process, is to introduce the streamlining features in many ways. Can we promote more predictability and equity among plaintiffs? And that'll help, I think, somewhat with the coverage costs as well. And a system that really promotes more effectively safe patient care. And I think you all could come to the same conclusion. It'll give us a safer patient care, lower costs, less defensive medicine, and reduce costs of all payers, including the Medicaid program.
Okay, is that it, Susan? Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And one more fact point,
yes,
one
yes,
more fact
sure.
point just to add to that. In response to your question about how much did the MRT take in savings with the creation of the medical indemnity fund, it was an $86 million reduction in the Medicaid budget in anticipation of the medical indemnity fund.
Right. I heard that. You recall that. Thank you.
It wasn't 100.
Well, thank you, Susan. Questions, Joel Glass, beginning?
It's not a question, but just a comment about how we develop premiums. New York State is the only state that I'm aware of that requires discounting in setting Med-Mal premiums. All other types of coverage, and in other states the type of coverage, does not count investment income in getting premiums. Now, so those states have more conservative premium settings than New York does. Particularly difficult for hospitals, because since they're not regulated, they have to set their own discount rate. And most hospitals, when they self-insure, will not set their discount rate at anything like a risk-free rate, if such a thing actually exists. And in 2008, hospitals all over the state took a huge beating because of the investment community. And, of course, what's going on now in the market makes it totally uncertain. So part of the problems in evaluating what true premium cost is for hospitals is the effect of the investment market. Even if a hospital takes what they consider a conservative approach and invests in bonds, well, what happens if we get inflation? They take a bath. They can't meet their reserves. So this is a difficult, time-consuming process of how to invest your assets, what to put it in, and whether or not you, which most hospitals do, use a very high discount rate that's difficult to meet.
It's very illuminating. I didn't know that, Joel. Other questions? Yes, Fred.
Yes, thank you. It's actually extremely helpful and interesting. And I ask this in a way which is not intended to be rhetorical, but may sound that way. By the way, I see Florida on your list of high severity, still low premium. It's still bugging me. I don't mean to annoy people by mentioning Florida. 36 years ago, I sat in Mr. Reske's position, chairing a state commission, looking at alternatives to the high cost of malpractice insurance. It was the beginning of the captive era. And what I think has happened since then, but I may be wrong, and I'm asking you if I'm wrong, is that the captive era allowed the good credits to take their business and leave town, leaving the rest of the market for the commercials who were not interested. I realize nothing can be done about that now. That is out of the bottle. But at the level of reinsurance, is there any kind of competition? Because you're all essentially self-insured, what I can see. Is there any competition at reinsurance that you could deal with rates, structure, and so forth?
First of all, the
Joel Glass's response.
Yeah. First of all, people went to captives mostly in New York because of the unavailability of commercial insurance. When claims made insurance, most of the commercial carriers went to claims made. Well, claims made is almost impossible to use for aggregate stop loss. I don't want to get too technical, but it doesn't work, right? So there's that works for reinsurance as well as commercial excess insurance. So there is no real market for it in New York now. Some smaller hospitals in upstate New York might have some availability. There's almost no availability downstate at all.
Okay, thank you.
Let me comment as well.
Lee Goldman.
The projection and the way we reserve funds, the insurance for future claims, is at best an art. And certainly reasonable people could vary in terms of how they would do that. But the occurrence rates are cash out the door today, and they tell a very clear story. So let's not get too confused because we say, oh, this is all hocus pocus. The occurrence rates give us very clear data on what's going on in the state, and they paint a very, very sad picture. Second, Fred, the reason why we went to a captive was actually more simple. At the time, there was concern about the viability of the other alternatives. And we at Columbia are insuring a large number of people who work for Ray University, and it made sense for us to band together with other people and to create a cooperative captive where we could be confident that that captive would not go belly up. So this is not pulling out. I just don't agree at all with your premise. These are various ways that different entities have struggled to deal with what, by the occurrence rates, are indisputably rising costs. And this is not, in my mind, there's no obfuscation here. There's no lack of data here. The data are really clear.
We all pick up the story at different points, and I'm eligible for Medicare. I always knew it would disappear just as I arrived at that point. But I was essentially referring to an earlier age, and an earlier age, we thought that captives would be a swell idea. Perhaps they still are. The question in my mind is the structure of the insurance product. I don't know of any other state that has the extraordinary centralization of power, authority, and control in the capital to set the business conditions for essentially self-insured providers. I'm not saying that anything can be done about that or should be done about it. I'm trying to get a sense of why, for example, the Florida obstetricians seem to have the same severity that Ms. Waltman points out. They're right up there, one of those dark blue states, and yet their premiums are right down there. Something, quite aside from everything else we might talk about the structure of how we insure providers in this state, is giving us a bad product, a costly product, put it that way. At least one factor.
I don't want to address the premium issue, but Florida seems to have a very large obstetrical premium in Miami-Dade, but I don't really, that's not my area, so I'm not going to go into it. But from hospitals, the proof is that almost all commercial markets for hospital malpractice went bankrupt or were severely impaired by writing medical malpractice for hospitals in New York State. Every one of them left the market with hundreds of millions of dollars of losses above premium. I mean, that's a fact.
Thank you, Fred. I have great respect for you, but I still can't follow your arithmetic. Everything I see here shows that the premiums in Florida are higher, and I've got two insurance people who are.
This morning there was a squib, and I guess it was in Cranes, about the state of Florida having their annual insurance report out. We pulled it off the internet, and so during the lunch hour we could take a look at that. Take a look at comparative premiums. What it does is just compares premiums across
the United. They were Mr. Taylor's red state as being amongst the very lowest.
No.
Just to recall that.
Anyway, we will clarify the database on that from this most recent Florida report. We have extra copies. Everybody can peruse it during the lunch hour. More questions? Any more questions? Nick, have that.
Susan, Nick Lepane. A couple of questions I have. First, Nick, you mentioned several times 54% of the cost being attributed to overhead. Do you have a breakdown of that 54% as far as specifically what overhead we're talking about?
Yeah, I can go back to the articles, but they are the Brennan, Stoddard, Mello articles. And we'll look behind those numbers and what the article says.
You know, Nick, we could save that question. Michelle Mello is going to be up next. So we could ask her of that from her studies.
Well, I was just curious as far as the
Greater
New York hospital in terms of the overhead costs. I would think that you've done some studies on the overhead costs, and I'm assuming that this 54% figure applies, or maybe doesn't apply, to your hospital group. I was just wondering what your information is.
I think that our
overhead and breakdown.
I have not done that calculation, but I do assume that we can do it within certain settings. I think what the piece is sometimes missing is what's the plaintiff.
Unless I'm missing something here. So wasn't that a secondary reference that you were talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. She was cross-referencing.
Oh, that's what I was
asking. Yeah,
that 54% comes from the article that I have up there. So the 54% appeared on the Mello article, and that's what there was one of their takeaways was how high the overhead cost is with respect to the compensation that actually goes to.
Art, are you going to answer the question?
Well, I'm just a very quick comment because I know I'm in the way of lunch. That's the value of having publicly accessible microcost data is that we would be able to assess that for ourselves. And just one caution, the Studdard, Mello, Brennan group of researchers have a very specific point of view that they've been drilling home for a decade. And I'm not saying, I'm not imputing anything to that. I'm just saying one set of researchers' opinions and judgments about what's going on is not the end of the story. And that's, again, the value of letting everybody out in the research community and the public look at the raw data and draw their own conclusions.
Excuse me, I just wanted to ask the second of my couple of questions. And something I think you have more of a firsthand experience with as opposed to this Mello study. And you mentioned, and of course, I commend it as far as the priority being patient safety, improving, or I should say, decreasing preventable adverse outcomes, which brings me to the firsthand experience that one of your hospitals have talked about and published articles about, and that is the New York Presbyterian OBGYN patient safety experience, and which came out, I believe, last February 2011. And in that study, they said that where safety programs have been looked at to see a correlation with reduction in preventable adverse outcomes, what has not been really studied is the next question. And that is whether or not there's any correlation between the reduction in those adverse outcomes and the reduction of medical malpractice payouts. And I think it would be an understatement to say that the New York Presbyterian experience showed there to be a clear correlation between the two, as evidenced by the fact that they pointed out that between the years, they started to implement over a period of years, their safety program in their OBGYN department. And it showed from, I believe, 2003 to 2006, the average medical malpractice payout by that department was $27.5 million per year. They then looked at the last 3 years of the study, from 2007 to 2009, which was well into their safety program. And the average medical malpractice payouts went down to $2.5 million, which is on average per year over that four-year experience versus the most recent three-year experience, more than 90% increase in payouts. What percentage of their payouts overall was that reduction?
I don't speak for your presbytery, but I do want to make a couple comments.
Your presbytery is one of your members.
But I can't speak, I won't speak for them about the study, but I will say the following things. First of all, it was Cornell. It was a New York Cornell study, so it was at one location. I do want you to know that we have, as part of our quality collaborative, perinatal safety collaborative that Lorraine will talk about, have incorporated for some time all of those interventions. So that hopefully, if they truly can result in reductions of adverse events or reductions in payouts, if they truly do that, seeing whether they translate to premium reductions. We've not seen that actually occur in our hospitals as yet. So rest assured that whatever is in that article is being, that first list that I had about all the different initiatives focusing on perinatal safety, all of those interventions are being pursued by us, by ACOG, by the insurers, by the state of New York in order to reduce those adverse events, reduce payouts, and hopefully reduce the coverage costs.
Well, lady, you want to comment on this subject?
I'd like to comment on a couple of subjects, actually. First, I will not sit here and have the Harvard malpractice study's veracity impugned. It's by far the best study, by far the most objective study
And people can certainly disagree with the results, but it is by far the best study. And I'll be here defending it, even when it argues against things that I might otherwise like to say. It is by, like I said, overwhelmingly the best study ever done on the subject. In terms of the malpractice issues at Cornell and Columbia, I'm reasonably familiar with them. I would be the first to applaud every effort to improve quality and to reduce malpractice costs as a result. I don't know the details of the department-by-department differences between Columbia and Cornell. I know that if you look at their overall premium and our overall premium, reflection of their overall cost and our overall cost, most of the differences are related to size of faculty practice. Ours being about a third bigger. And the other is easily explainable by the huge difference in Medicaid population. So we take care of three times as many Medicaid deliveries as Cornell. So if one simply looks at the experience that, that Joel talked about in terms of differences by Medicaid population, it's easily explained by those two things. Cornell's experience before their quality control interventions was substantially worse than ours, and now overall is about like ours. So, again, in favor of all these sorts of things, but these are not going to be interventions that are going to reduce malpractice prisons by 95%. That's just a, okay, thank you. Illogical.
Yeah, this was a question for Susan. She doesn't know, and if Mr. Goldman does, feel free to answer.
Dr. Polk.
This is not related to the next question about the 54%. As neither of you know, we go to Ms. Melendez, that's fine too.
Uh-huh.
But my understanding was, got a big chunk of that was, first of all, that was based upon the original Harvard study.
The 54%, and she will speak to this, but the 54% is this, comes from that study where they looked at claims closed during that 1995 to 2004 time frame. So they're fresher claims than the Harvard malpractice. But, okay.
Okay, so it's from the early 90s.
I would say, yes, in that time frame.
Okay. Do we know what complies with that 55%? That question. My impression, I thought,
the article does go through what is the overhead and how much of that doesn't go to the patient. I mean, that's really the point. How much is being spent and not going to the patient?
Yeah.
And I will look behind that, and we'll see how much there is behind it in terms of what's the overhead. But it's the legal fee all the way, both sides.
Well, does that then contemplate the fact that the law changed and that legal fees on behalf of plaintiffs and what you call dictates are roughly a third or less of what they have been?
Okay, so I think we're going to take lunch.
One sec. This is Art Fugner again, and if I can forward to the committee an editorial which from the chairman of the department at Maimonides, Howard Minkoff, who was commenting on the Cornell study.
Oh, yeah.
And it's probably very illustrative. This was republished in the Albany Times-Union, and I will, with your permission, distribute it to the co-chairs of the committee. Basically, you have to realize that this is a preliminary study. It's being done, as was mentioned, in one hospital of a system, in a very closed system, where practices could be controlled. And the other thing that's not mentioned in the study, of course, is what the cesarean rates were during the performance of the study, and I think that's also illustrative. So
we'll distribute that to all the members. We have it at our end.
And I think this afternoon, Lorraine and Art and the representative from Midney, who's not arrived yet, we'll be talking more about patient safety. So if there are additional questions about the study and comments people want to make, we'll have plenty of time to do that.
Okay, so we'll resume deliberations at 2:30.
Mr. Chairman, if I may interrupt, this is Michelle Mello from the Harvard School of Public Health. Florence Abrams asked me to join at 2 o'clock, and I'm just wondering if you still need me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Michelle, this is Laura. This is Laura LaFave.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, how you doing? Can we, I understood you were available between 2 and 3, so we're going to take a quick biological break, and then probably be back around 2:30. So if you could rejoin us at 2:30, that would be very helpful.
Okay, I'll call in at 2:30.
Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Well, thank you so much. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
If you're on the panel and you ordered lunch, I think they're outside with your names on them, so you can just go out to the table there and grab them.
But no food in here.
All right. All right. Thanks. Oh, yeah. No, you do. No pressure.
I was going to tell you, too, if you do